Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled The Supreme Court, Its Power, Influence, and Impact. Richard Epstein, Tisch Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, joins host Dennis McQuestion in this episode from 2024 to examine the critical Supreme Court cases that could reshape the balance of power between federal agencies and the courts, redefine property rights, and determine how the First Amendment applies to social media platforms. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, hi, I'm Dennis McQuestion, and the program you're about to see was recorded a few weeks ago in early 2024. The Supreme Court was in session, and they were hearing very important issues. Some of those issues may have been decided by the time you see this program, but stay with us, and you'll get all the facts as presented by the most knowledgeable lawyer in America who is not on the Supreme Court. His name is Richard Epstein. Enjoy. Well, welcome. I'm Dennis McQuestion, and we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court and, in particular, what issues are facing the Supreme Court right now that may impact you, whether you know it or not, whether you care or not. We've got in this country, allegedly, a separation of powers, the executive branch, legislative branch, and the judicial branch. And the top court, of course, in the judicial branch is the Supreme Court. And joining us to talk about these issues is a returning guest of ours, Richard Epstein. He is was the speaker today for the Institute for Policy Innovation in Dallas, and that's why he's in town. He is, however, the Tisch Professor of Law at NYU. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's Distinguished Service Professor of Law Emeritus at the University of Chicago. Richard, welcome to the program, and let me just ask you, start with the issue that you think that viewer wants to hear about.
Well, I think it's very important to recognize that the Supreme Court now has more than its fair share of cases that people regard as fundamental and revolutionary. And so what I'm just going to do is to talk about some of the cases in which I've had either a bit part or a slightly larger than bit part, which I think affect everybody. I think the first case on this particular list is a case involving what they call the Chevron Doctrine. And this is the keystone of modern administrative law. And what the Supreme Court decided some years ago, 1984, was that if there was a question of law which was difficult to interpret, you followed a two-step process. If the rule was clear, then what it is, you followed the rule. But if the rule was unclear, what you did is you thought to defer to the administrative agency, which was said to have the kind of expertise that would make for better decisions. This decision had a long run of being very popular from about 1984 to, say, about 2010. But the dangers of the rule became much more apparent. And so starting around 2010, 2015, you saw many efforts on the part of the Supreme Court to duck the Chevron question in one way or another. And this past term, it reached the culmination on the issue as to whether or not Chevron should be overruled. Let me just go at it in two ways. The first way is, what was Chevron about? And it was about a very technical question of whether or not, when you have a bunch of smokestacks out of a single facility, are they treated as separate pollution sources on the one hand, or a single pollution source on the other hand? And this is regarded by most people as counting, you know, the number of angels that could sit on the head of a pin, but it's much more important than that. If each smokestack is separate, then every time you want to switch power between smokestacks, you have to have an environmental permit. And the Democrats, who tend to favor heavy environmental voting, were in favor of that. The Republican view, called the bubble concept, said if these smokestacks are in close proximity with one another, you treat them as one facility. And essentially, if you want to change the mix of output between the different smokestacks, it's all good. As a political matter, I think that the second view is clearly preferable, because what it allows you to do at low administrative costs is to increase the output within the system without increasing the pollution that it generates, which is generally to the good. And in the lower court, then Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, no, we have to be very, very tough on this. And then what Judge John Paul Stevens said is, you know, we're going to give them deference and we think it's a perfectly reasonable choice. We're not going to decide one way or another. So the original case was actually a kind of pro-market, pro-conservative case.
Let me stop you right there, Richard. You've given us a lot to think about. But here's the question. Is this a situation where what the Supreme Court's going to decide is whether or not these regulatory agencies have, let's just say, the power to be the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury? Or is this something that will, if it goes the other way, limit what government can do, limit what the regulatory agencies can do to what the legislation says?
This is only on pure questions of law. This is not on questions of fact. And essentially what Chevron says is that the court in a doubtful case can make a rule of law that will bind the courts. And the usual way is to put it the other way. If you don't have an administrative agency involved, the high court will look at the thing what they call de novo on its own view, and they won't care what the administrative agency says unless they think it's right. So it's a huge shift in the power of these things. And in the current case, it has a very special context. These are two cases of fishing boats, which are regulated by an obscure government agency. And it is widely understood under the statute that when you're dealing with this, the government has the power to force you to take somebody on board to inspect the fish that are being captured. And then the agency on its own motion says, we don't have enough money to do everything they want. Now you have to pay for the people who are coming on the board, and there is no clear statutory authorization to do this. The amount of money involved in this one case is, say, 20% of profits. And so they were attacked. And the narrow argument is only Congress can appropriate money. You can't delegate that authority to an agency. And the broader definition is says this is just an illustration of administrative agencies going wild to expand their power. It's up before the Supreme Court now. I've always been a foe of the Chevron doctrine, thinking that law questions should be decided by law. And it looks, if you take this, that the 6-3 majority for the conservatives will hold, and that this particular doctrine will disappear. This is after 40 years of consistent enforcement, and I think it amounts to a genuine revolution in the way in which the administration will play. And ordinary people ought to note that this is a doctrine which is not tied to any particular area of subject matter. So we have Chevron cases on environmental admission, Chevron cases on situations having to do with securities regulation, labor law, and all sorts of other things. Okay. And so it's going to affect everything.
Right. Okay, good. So that's a lot of Chevron. Next issue that you want to talk about that you're involved in.
Okay, well, I mean, there's also the whole question about property rights in the United States and the extent to which the government can regulate the way in which people use their property and, in some cases, the way in which they rent it out to other people. And what has happened is the rent control issue has a long and somewhat complicated history, but it started out as a short-time war measure that was imposed around 1919 after the First World War, when there were huge numbers of people coming into Washington for jobs, and they said landlords could not raise rents because of the influx of people. That's not a very smart rule. You want them to raise rents so that you can induce more people to put housing in the market. But this thing lasted for only 3 years, and when the District of Columbia tried to renew it, the Supreme Court said, sorry, the emergency over. You can't do it. And then it sort of transformed itself into a perpetual machine so that in places like New York, they said there's always going to be an emergency so long as you have a vacancy rate which is under 5%. But of course, if you depress the rents, it's always going to be below 5%. And so when they put this so-called rent stabilization order in place in 1962, every couple of years they would renew it, but they never found a case where the emergency ended. And this is a very odd emergency. This is not people coming into the country. This is not a storm or a tornado. It's a legislative-created situation which they use to keep rents down. And it's very popular locally because landlords don't vote the same number as tenants do. You try to put limitations on the price that you can sell your house, you're going to get a revolution. And what has happened is they keep tightening the rules. They allow rent control to go not only to the tenant but to his children. And then recently what they did is they extended the reach and the power of this in 2018 when it turned out that the Republicans lost the Senate and so the Democrats could do what they will, and they had this progressive situation. So even if you were within the stabilization rate, they put a new limitation upon you, and a very large group of landlords decided to protest this. A lot of clout. out. I was asked to write and did write an amicus brief on this stuff. And the Supreme Court now has to decide whether or not it's going to upend rent control. You want to figure out what that's
okay,
worth.
So let me stop you for a second, Richard. Are they going to do it or are they not going to do it?
Well, we don't even know yet, and I'll tell you why. This is a case which has to be granted by the Supreme Court. And they've had it now in conference 10 times, and they've yet to decide whether they want to take it or they don't want to take it. If they do take it, it's a sign that they're going to make a major shift in the system. And if they make a major system in the system, then every rental agreement in the United States, which is bound by the rent control laws of New York State, may be in jeopardy, and the whole thing will be liberalized. This would be a massive change because the way it works in New York City now, there's a huge imbalance. You live in a rent control unit, say, which has 2,100 square feet and 3 bedrooms and 2 baths, and you can't pay more than $2,500 a month in rent. You go across the street to somebody who's not in a rent control unit, and they're paying $10,000, $11,000, or $12,000. And so if you get rid of the rent control system or modify it, one group of renters are going to pay much less and the other group of renters are going to pay a lot more, but the market will be much more efficient in terms of how it operates. So I'm strongly in favor of them forcing constitutional limits in these cases.
Okay, let me go to another one. I'm going to pick one this time, one that's hanging in there right now and may be decided before this program airs even. And that's the border issue with Texas and Washington talking about who ought to be in control of the closing the border, opening the border, regulating the border quickly now, quickly. What do you think about that issue?
Oh, my God. First of all, it's not even up before the Supreme Court yet, but it will surely be up there one way or another. And in general, my view is that in ordinary times, stress ordinary times, this is going to be exclusively the function of the federal government. You ask, where does the authority come? It turns out there's no constitutional authority which says that the United States has power over immigration. There's federal power over naturalization, which is very different. And what happened is the Supreme Court for many years basically introduced a rule which says we can't let states decide the question of how it is we deal with immigration, because if one state decides to let everybody in, they're going to move across the entire country. So it became a federal power. But it didn't become a federal power by an explicit grant. It became a kind of a necessity situation. Now what you do is you have the Biden administration, which by everybody's judgment seems to have fallen short. There are massive people crossing across the border. They go into the interior of the country where they put additional burdens on all of the state agencies that have to watch them. People are busing them back and forth across the United States to get them out. It's a genuine crisis.
Yeah. So it also is tied up, obviously, with politics and with this year's politics. And so let me ask you about another issue that is liable to be settled maybe before this program airs. And that's the ability of former President Trump to be on the ballot in Colorado and Maine and perhaps other states. That's a huge issue. Talk to us about that, please.
Yeah, that issue is going to come to the Supreme Court in one way or another. But it involves one of the most complicated provisions in the Constitution, which is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which hasn't been invoked basically since about 1872 or somewhere about that. It was originally designed to make sure that people who worked in the Confederacy could not take positions in the federal government. And the way in which they structured it is they listed 4 groups of people who are categorically subject to this kind of limitation. And they were representatives and senators and electors for the president and the vice president, but not the president and the vice president. What they were thinking is if we keep the Electoral College clean, we can run a general election. And this was the way to do it. What's happened is when most people read the amendment today, they cut out all those 4 categories and they start to talk about any officer being subject to it, and the president sits in the executive office. But the term officer in the American Constitution is a statutory term, a defined term, somewhat arbitrary. So if you look at the Appointments Clause, you discover that the president appoints all officers of the United States, either with or without Senate confirmation. And the president can't be somebody who is appointed by himself, so he's not governed by this. And this means when you talk about office in the Constitution, the president is out. The only people who count as officers are those who essentially get appointed to office, and the Congress can then reject them. Congress has no way in which it could reject the president because he's elected through an electoral system. So people have contrived the argument, which I regard as simply over the top, saying, well, it's a self-executing Amendment. That's not what they mean. Self-executing was the 14th Amendment, insofar as what it says is everybody who's born in the United States is a citizen thereof, and that essentially made every former slave a citizen of the United States. It was self-executing. What they want to say is self-executing means that anybody throughout the nation could decide to sue in state court to ban the guy on the grounds that they think he engaged in an insurrection, a very difficult concept. This is political mayhem. So I think what really is going to happen is the Supreme Court will reject the Colorado definition of an insurrection, which is basically voter obstruction, two or more people getting together to keep somebody from the polls in an effort to change the outcome of an election, right? That's much too broad. And what they should do is they should not say, well, this is the wrong time to bring this suit, or other people have to bring it. They should just shut the entire thing down, because the correct analysis of this particular problem is the political system, once you keep the House of Representatives and once you keep the Electoral College clean, is the political process should handle it. And I think it's a kind of a real danger that they would go in the opposite way. But I think as it gets closer and closer to the election, people have come to the following conclusion. You can't say you believe in democratic processes if you're going to take a very artificial argument and use it to keep the most prominent Republican candidate off the ballot.
Okay, well put. Talking about government still and things that do affect the ballot and do affect elections and have affected elections and will continue to, that's the issue of information. And particularly today, I mean, in the old days, Richard, when you and I were growing up, we had three news networks, and of course, PBS came along, and now we have social media all over the place. And as the old joke goes, if it says that on the internet, heck, it must be true. So there's obviously a lot of misinformation, disinformation, in a lot of places, not just social media, sometimes the mainstream media, as we also know. But there are efforts now that are going to be coming before the Supreme Court about government censorship of these areas. Talk to us about that particular issue.
What you're talking about is the NetChoice case. It involves regulations in Florida and in Texas. It just so happened I submitted a brief on that case to the Supreme Court last week, so I'm pretty much under it. And the basic situation was, if you are a social media platform, under the regulations, you have to make room for people whose views are different from your own, and you can't keep them up. There are a bunch of other things which I don't think are particularly important. And so the question is, which way do you think about it? I am strongly of the view that the statutes in question are not only constitutional but necessary, and all of this depends upon how you think of the media. So you started to say in the good old days, right, when we were young. Well, the key case is a case called Tornillo, decided in 1974 against the Miami Herald, I think it was. And what happened is the Supreme Court was faced with the question of whether or not the local government could say, by regulation, that if you put a given view on the network, you have to make space for a reply. And they said, look, these are competitive countries and a competitive market, and there are lots of other outlets that you can do it. The part of the opinion which is not commonly known is they also had a view, a case involving the Associated Press back in 1945, which said that just because you're a media outlet does not mean that you are immune from the antitrust law. So if you have two outlets getting together and deciding to control the news, you can sue them not because the news press is protected, but because of the collusion. And the Supreme Court goes into great length about that danger. So the key issue is you actually take that case, is this or is this not some kind of a combined operation? If it is, then in fact you should be subject to rights of reply, and I think they are. Now, why is it? Well, in the briefest form, there are three kinds of reasons that you can deal with. One is, in our youth, we never worried about, they call about network effects. And network effects are a tendency, if you have a large number of people, other people want to interact with those people directly or through other means indirectly. And so large networks tend to get larger and small networks tend to remain small until something happens and, you know, MySpace is gone and all of a sudden you got another dominant player on the book, Facebook or Meta. So that's a monopoly tendency. But more importantly, I think in many ways, is there are three companies that provide web services. And what those are, not facing the consumer, but facing getting onto the pipes of the system. And what happens is they can cut you off with or without cause. And so, for example, after J6, there was a network called Parler, which was a kind of a conservative network. And all the three players cut them off, Apple, Google, and Amazon. They're gone, and they can't get back, and they're out of business. And they've never been able to find another platform to do it. Now, this power is crazy. It's really strong. They claim they have it at will. And then they say, but there was cause for it because they're defending violence. Now, this is such an amorphous charge. You don't know whether they were reporting on it, agreeing with it or not. The sanction is absolutely great. They don't say, well, you're going to look at this video and take it off and that. So they're basically abusing power. And I don't think anybody should have that kind of power to shut down the entire discourse. And the third thing is there's very extensive involvement by both carrots and sticks of the Biden administration in defining what is or is not information and misinformation on really important things like how do we deal with COVID and the vaccines and lockdown, how we think about climate change and so forth. And the evidence in a case called Missouri against Biden is overwhelming that the federal government was involved at every stage of this thing, promising benefits to networks that cooperated, punishing those that did not. And so essentially what happened is the moment the government takes that kind of role, it's no longer a private competitive industry, it's a government monopoly. And if you then go back to the case that I just talked about, if you're on the monopoly side, the applicable precedent isn't the Tornillo case having to do with individual newspapers, it's the Associated Press case having to do with collective refusals to deal. And so everything is going to depend upon the characterization of this case. And my view is that the briefs on the other side were sadly deficient because what they did is they stressed the wonderful importance of autonomous information gathering institution. My argument is you're right about that, but you don't have those informations now. And unless you enter the antitrust charges, you're going to be wrong. How is it going to come out? This is going to be a close one. Because the two state courts on this, Texas and Florida, came out opposite ways. And it's very difficult, even with this Supreme Court, to sort of figure out which way they're likely to go and why. My guess is it will be 5-4 or 6-3. I'm not sure of the direction. Confidence in this outcome has actually increased since I started writing the particular brief, and I hope that when they look at the two sides, they will realize that all the defenders of the autonomy view don't confront squarely the monopoly question.
Okay, I have two or three other issues, and we only have a few minutes left, as you might imagine, but I want to ask you to in some way educate that viewer on something that is sort of obscure. I think it's called the shadow docket that has become, at least last year, a big thing in the newspaper. What the heck is it, and why should that viewer care?
Well, I mean, it is a very mysterious sort of document. It was a term introduced about 10 years ago by a colleague of mine of Chicago named Will Bode. And what happens is there are many, many cases that are decided today by the Supreme Court that don't get a full hearing and a full argument. And the theory about the shadow docket is that you can use this particular device to make major changes in the law without having to go through the usual clarity of an oral argument. So it's supposed to be a sign of illegitimacy. I think, in effect, everybody has used it a little bit because sometimes you have a case that's new and there's been a recent Supreme Court precedent, and what the shadow docket will do is say, re-examine the opinion that you wrote here in the light of the case that we just surprised. So I think it's kind of overrated as a serious problem, and here's the way I would try to put it most simply. Think of the cases that really have attracted attention recently, right? You know, we overrule Roe v. Wade in a case called Dobbs and so forth. Was that done on the shadow docket? No, it wasn't done on the shadow docket, and virtually every other major case that attracts public attention is something that has gotten full argument. And so I think it's a rather sad thing because the way in which it tends to operate now, and this was not part, I think, of Bode's intention, is that it is used as a way to sort of try to delegitimate the Supreme Court by saying they're taking shortcuts against things that should be otherwise done. And the most alarming political trend, in my mind, is exactly this effort to constantly say, well, this one has to disqualify himself because his wife wore that one. This one got too many royalties on a book and so forth. I think, in effect, it's extremely important when you deal with the Supreme Court is to try to leave it going. And so one of the kind of issues that I think is a real hot-button issue is do you have some kind of a system of ethics disclosure that could be enforceable against members of the Supreme Court? Today, it's always been you have to decide whether or not to recuse yourself, and there are very few cases of abuse. But you get Senator Whitelaw, he thinks everybody's kind of corrupt. And he says, I can't control it, but I'm going to create a system where chief justices of the federal circuits can now pass on any claim for disqualification raised by any citizen. And that's a little bit like what happened in the erection case. You will literally have thousands of people saying something's wrong in these cases, and it undermines the Supreme Court. So you want to keep the doctrine of separation of powers and say the current disclosure system, even if straight, might not be perfect, but it's a lot better of what's going to take place in the alternative. And I think you have to do such simple things as give federal protection so that people don't have to live in houses where folks can make noise outside their front door morning, noon, and night, driving the families to distraction. And the Biden administration refuses to supply it, and the states refuse to supply it. And yet there's a clear command which says that picketing, which might be appropriate around a public place, has no business around somebody's residential home. And so I think, in effect, there is a kind of a crisis in this particular circumstance. But I think the crisis that we're talking about are delegitimation efforts. And why are they trying to delegitimate? Because the basic belief on the part of the left is the court is a conservative institution. And they know it's not 100% correct, but they see Dobbs and they see Chevron being going down the tubes, and they're willing to go full bore about it. And that's just not the way you do it. The way you do it is to win elections and to appoint people whom you prefer for the Supreme Court, which you may get through if you have the Senate. Otherwise, it's always going to be a tussle.
Well, I don't know about the other viewers, but for me, I feel like I've been drinking out of fire hose listening to you, Richard, talking about these issues. And I would say one thing in just the moment that we have left. Hatton Sumners was a congressman from Texas back in the 30s, and he almost exclusively was the person who kept Roosevelt from packing the Supreme Court back in those days. And of course, the Democrats have tried to thought about that at least in the last few years. So, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. And for all of you, in the next few weeks, you'll hear how the Supreme Court has decided these and other issues. And here is our hope that you now have a better educated perspective on how these things may fall and how they may impact you, your family, your friends. So join us on social media, questiontv.com. And the next program we're going to do on classical liberalism, because we always talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.